the privilege of being on two lists, and what we thought we would do today is give you a little bit of a picture into what some of these lists are about and what they're and what they mean in the lives of some of us that are on. I have a copy of an article that was printed in the Provo Daily Herald in 1995 at the beginning of one of these lists. And I'll just read it here as a way of introduction. Unofficial Mormon Ward on Internet. Imagine a ward within the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints with an almost 80% activity rate, likely homemaking meetings, and members who build up one another in a non-judgmental manner. It sounds like the envy of any bishop, but it has one problem. It cannot be found in the real world. This unofficial unit of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints exists on the Internet, in that ethereal realm known as cyberspace. There are no sacrament meetings, but the managers of the list say that this virtual ward that exists provides church contact for those on the margins of LDS society and a safe haven for working through questions of faith. This mailing began 2 years ago to provide an electronic forum to discuss LDS gender issues and feminism in an understanding environment. A lot of people have said that this is their only contact with the church. Lists such as these give a place to say what is sometimes difficult in a ward setting. The electronic ward popped into existence shortly after ELWC Plus's creation. As I recall, we were talking about the various positions we held in the church and which callings we didn't like. One woman volunteered to be the nursery leader in the virtual ward, she said. From there, others volunteer or offer the names of those who could be called to different positions. This is the only ward in the church that is led mostly by women, but there's no sacrament meetings or gospel doctrine classes in this electronic meeting house. What the virtual ward does is reproduce what goes on in the lobby. That's one of the descriptions of this list. The four panelists that are going to be giving you this glimpse will introduce themselves, talk a few minutes about what being on lists like this means in their lives and their role, and then they will go on to read some examples in the Reader's Theater format. So I'll start with Jana. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Jana Reese, and I'm a graduate student at Columbia University in American Religious History. And I've been a member of LDS Women, which is kind of a small list that's invitation only, for about 2.5 years. And considering that I've only been a member of the church for 4 years, I suppose that that's some ratio, you know. For me, LDS Women, I used to be on another list called ELWC, which I think some other people will be talking about, and it's actually ELWC that someone has called these posts from. ELWC is co-ed, it's both men and women. LDS Women is only women, and I decided that that was the community that I really wanted on the Internet because it's a very supportive environment. I went to a women's college, and yay, I'm into single-sex environments. I think some of the specific things that have happened to me in the last couple of years that have been really important to me, one of the first places that I wanted to run and talk about was this list, LDS Women. And one of them was 2 years ago I took a self-defense course, I guess that's the best way to term it, kind of a self-defense women's empowerment course in New York City. And it's called model mugging. Most people laugh when they hear that. But it's an extremely powerful experience and a very difficult experience. And I had a really hard time finishing the class. It's only a few weeks long, but it's very, very intense. I actually went online and was describing some of the things that I was going through in the class. And the kind of response that I got was amazing to me, because most of the women on the list are women that I've never met before, or maybe occasionally, like Cherie, bump into at a conference. But I do feel a tremendous amount of closeness to these women. And most recently, just a few weeks ago, I posted in a frantic moment, because I have just taken my PhD comprehensive exams, and posted and said, I'm going out of my mind. Someone please tell me that I'm okay, that I'm not going to fail, and everything's going to be all right. And again, this kind of tremendous outpouring of support that came through cyberspace really floored me. And I don't think that this kind of internet community is a substitute for a word community. but it's very complimentary, and I wouldn't think that my ward experience would be as rich as it is if I didn't have this outlet. And the last thing that I want to say is something that I posted a couple of weeks ago, too, which is that I have a good friend who is a professor, and she's a member of a conservative Protestant denomination, which shall remain nameless, but she has all of her life been in this denomination and has found quite recently that she doesn't have the kind of support in the denomination that she would like. And I was telling her about this list and saying there are a lot of things that I would never feel comfortable talking about with women in my ward that I feel comfortable even just asking about how do you feel about this on the list. And she said, we don't have anything like that, but I sure want to start one now. And it's a pretty exciting thing that's going on. That's pretty much it.
My name is Cherie Woodworth. I'm a graduate student at Yale in history. And I've been on this list, ELWC, since it began. As to the best of my memory, it was fall of 1993. And it was started as a private list by Lynn Anderson, who introduced Fonda Alamo earlier today, if you remember. And it was started partly because there had been some internet groups discussing Mormon issues, and the women on the internet, although a number of women were subscribing to the list, they weren't posting. And Lynn had talked with some of these, and there was a pretty universal feedback saying, we just don't like the environment. We find that the men are too aggressive in their posting. They're too impersonal. We don't have any sense of community, and we feel attacked. And also, we want to talk about issues that are of interest to us, and they're not of interest to these other people. So Lynn started this list, invited both men and women, but primarily women, and said, let's talk about things that are of interest to you, and let's talk about them in a way that you feel safe talking about them. And I think that over the number of years that I've been on the list, to me, it seems like it's created an incredible environment to talk about things that you wish you could talk about if you had your best friend there, but your best friend isn't there. And it's a strange environment in that you can reveal yourself in ways that you maybe couldn't if the person was sitting right in front of you. But you always wanted to be able to ask these questions, or sometimes you're torn up over something, and you can sit down and write it out and in a way share it and still keep enough of yourself back behind the screen so that you aren't completely vulnerable. There's just a sort of reader's theater that was put together by Laurie Stromberg, who's out in California, I think partly by request and instigation of some other people who've been attending Sunstone and were asking about these sorts of lists. And these are posts that were culled from this list and probably occurred at least a year ago. And they cover a number of topics that we hope to go over just briefly. If there's time for question and answers afterwards, I'd like to share with you some of my favorite topics that have come up on the list, which are not included in here. And just to confirm what Janice said about this idea of community, this time last year, I was taking my comprehensive exams. And when I was going crazy, I wrote in and said, I can't believe this. You know, I can't remember all of this stuff. And again, I got lots of messages of support. And when I took my exams on May 8th, 1996, I came home. Immediately, my husband was home. I said, I passed. Everything was excited. I said, I'm so exhausted. I went and fell asleep. Then I said, oh, but you've got to get on email and tell them that I passed. And I was too excited and exhausted to do it myself. But my husband got on. He says, I'm posting for my wife. And he put it in sort of terms like it's alive. It's a happy baby boy. But it's a happy past exam. Mother is resting right now. And it was something both to share with them and to have them share back with me.
My name is Tanya Rands, and I'm a grad student in sociology at Princeton. I don't think this grad student thing is necessarily representative of the makeup of the list. It ranges all over the demographic map. Mm-hmm. And I first came to the internet the first year that I came to graduate school. That was the first time someone handed me a free email account. Mm-hmm. And the various contacts started hooking me into the LDS internet, and I gradually made my way through a list or two until I connected with ELWC. Which was really significant to me because I came from the Bay Area in California where I grew up and where I'd gone to school at Berkeley, where there was a thriving, vibrant singles ward that I'd been very involved in the years before I left to come out to central New Jersey, which is a very beautiful place ecologically, but a wasteland in terms of Mormon population. And I felt this huge drop in my network, in my sense of social ties, which were very important to me. And so I kind of scrabbled and ended up meeting my needs through the net in a lot of ways. And especially with this group, I was just amazed. And I've had a lot of discussions with people about whether or not it's possible to have community on the internet. And I agree that it will never take the place of flesh and blood community, but that it is amazingly complementary. And I have sat in front of a computer terminal in a computer room and wept or just been dumbstruck by this aha moment that someone has opened my eyes to, or had chills go down my spine as I read somebody's story, or maybe more often than anything else, laughed out loud and had everyone look at me like I was a weirdo, from just the wit and the warmth and the amazing minds. It's just an amazing sense of strength to be tapped into a group of people like that. I remember I organized a discussion group with those very few Mormons who were in my area, in the ward. And I remember we were sitting around the table, we were trying to come up with the answer to some question I wasn't know, and I said, well, I'll take it to the net. And there was this amazing sense of power. I had this thing behind this oracle that I knew if I just came and typed it in, I would have an answer within 24 hours because somebody would know or somebody would know where to know. And it's just this feeling of being spread out over the whole world and being networked in. It's very modern 90s and kind of cool, which I enjoy.
Okay. I'm Tracy Ensign, and I'm not a graduate student. I'm in the defense contracting industry right now in this area. I've been around computers for years, but just recently got my own, and Nancy Cater got me on the ELWC. So mainly so far, I've just been enjoying the posts, and I find it useful to just keep in touch with what's going on in the Mormon world. There are all kinds of posts from Utah and things you wouldn't ordinarily hear back in this area. So that's been the main value to me so far.
Shall we start? Yeah. I wanted to just explain something before we start. Each time it changes reader, you should assume that it's a totally different person writing. Not that every time I speak it's the same person. And also, we're not a very good demographic representation. One of the good things about this email thing to me is that we have women who are in their 60s, and then we have women who are in their 20s, and we have women all the way through in between. So if you can imagine, and men, fewer men, but we have men too. If you can imagine sometimes speaking, if we're speaking in the voice of a woman of several different generations, it would help. Okay, Tracy, start.
Okay. Before I could read, I phonetically assumed the Relief Society was the Release Society. So perhaps the Ward from Hell should celebrate the cyberbirth of a Release Society, a society dedicated to releasing women from make-work tasks they don't really want to do. We can also celebrate the release from the curious ritual whereby women gather to read and repeat what men say about them. We can vote to release from her calling the doctrinal purity czarina in every ward in the church. All in favor? We can eat Belgian chocolate to release pheromone or whatever brain chemical it is that makes women very, very happy.
You know, the core assumption behind 19th century polygamy was that male Mormons would be crowned kings and priests when they entered into their exaltations. The chief metaphor for the measure of dominion this kingship carried was the number of jewels in one's crown. Each wife, each child, was another jewel. Now, each jewel brought a world, each wifely jewel at least, a world for every wife. Your celestial reward, if you were male, was in direct proportion to the size of your family kingdom on earth. Somewhere in the 20th century, this family kingdom building mentality was left by the roadside. Instead, the nuclear model was bought into, lock, stock, and barrel. The mindset of jewels and crowns was lost, as was the ordinance that institutionalized the doctrine, and ironically ordained women to the fullness of the priesthood. Late 20th century leaders don't buy into the world for every wife model. I don't think they'll reinstate polygamy.
Mormons defer to authority, seek their truth from authority, believe that the authorities will take care of them, and so on. It makes Mormons the ideal pawns in a corporate world.
Don't you think it depends on the authorities?
I guess I have my own personal biases here, but I found that these tendencies to defer to authority have literally crippled me intellectually.
These threads have got me wondering about the traits that Mormon culture fosters. It's pretty clear what is officially emphasized, but how close is that to what is actually produced, if one can generalize? For instance, despite the never-ending lessons on decorous helpmeet behavior for the girls, increasingly large numbers of young women go on missions, where no one much wants them to, or leave the church, or both. Is that apparent erosion from the outside? I'd be interested to hear what folks know about the current lives of the women in particular. Can we do an impressionistic census? Who's the ward demographer, anyway?
About missions. I don't even want to get into the ethics of going or not going. One of the reasons that I went was because I anticipated getting married someday, and I did not want my husband to be able to hold that over me. I've always fought the urge to make the priesthood equals leadership equals spiritual superiority connection because my father was a bishop and an intellectual. And he always had research answers to my questions. I wanted to validate my own spiritual strength by serving a mission. I do think that the church desperately needs a woman on the decision-making committee for the missionary program. I never heard so much woman bashing in my life until on my mission. The men had this great leadership network in which they were taught to keep those sisters in line and not to let our superior maturity level intimidate them. We had one sisters' conference, the first and the last, my president said, in which we were taught how to dress, accessorize, and glamorize. Not possible, you say, but it happened. A full day of makeup and hair grooming instruction. I also remember a 70 giving a talk at Zone Conference entitled, "The Harder You Work on Your Mission, the More Beautiful Your Wife Will Be." Seriously, his talk began and ended with that statement. No wonder so many of these returned missionary men at BYU are such assholes. What are we teaching our young men?
I'd ask you to tell us you were kidding, but I have the sinking feeling you're not. Imagine giving up 2 years of your life, turning over your body, mind, and spirit to a religious enterprise, and then entering a community of systematic woman bashing. Is it always like this for sister missionaries?
No, I loved my mission. That's why it took me 10 freaking years to leave the church.
Actually, in my mission, we had a wonderful mission president's wife. We did a lot of bring the high and mighty elders down to earth type things. She would ask pointed questions whenever an elder would make sweeping statements about the gospel. Prior to joining the church, she was a Catholic nun and was quite a scriptorium. However, there were numerous rules that applied to the sisters and not the elders. Looking back on it, I'm ashamed that I didn't speak up about it. Sisters had an earlier curfew than the elders, but we were still required to put in as many hours. Go figure. And we weren't allowed to use missionary cars, but sisters were forbidden to ride bikes. Gag, I can't believe I put up with so much silliness while I was a missionary.
In our mission, sister missionaries were quite autonomous and by the mission president quite respected. He would rather have had more sister missionaries and fewer elders, I know, from a few comments he made to me. The sisters didn't cause quite the problems that the elders did. Our sister conferences were wonderful. Training skills, life skills, time to watch a movie, time to visit, bond. The area presidency stopped those, much to the mission president's dismay. I think he felt bad that the elders had monthly training conferences, and this was his way of offering a similar break to the sisters. I think he also would have had female assistants and staff if he could have pulled it off. The mission president's wife was more oppressive than any of the men I knew. She thought we should spend more time on our hair and makeup, like it wouldn't be ruined immediately in the frequent rain, and to wear suits, like you can ride a bike in a suit skirt. She also had a contest for all the sisters to lose weight before the conference, and there would be money for the winning sister to buy a new outfit. I didn't participate. I feel bad for those whose missions were oppressive. It's hard enough to do the right thing as it is, without that kind of crap going on. I was told by God that a mission was where I needed to be, and that's why I went. It wasn't the easiest thing I've ever done, but I did what I thought was best, and now it's over. No regrets, almost.
I remember being on my mission and struggling with the terror that God hated me because I was bad. It took a lot to overcome that. For me, it was a secret sin that I'd never told anyone about, but many times I knew that anything that went wrong was my fault because God was punishing me. Are women on missions particularly susceptible to that fear? Is there something in the structure of missions that makes women more vulnerable to it? Overall, I regard my mission as a positive and good experience, but it was so indescribably painful sometimes.
In the early months of my mission, I was incredibly guilt-stricken because I wasn't doing everything I was commanded to do by the mission president. But being the wicked one that I was, I sat down one prep day and calculated the hours necessary to do absolutely everything we were ordered to do. Totaled something like 28 hours a day. So, in a flash, I realized that I was free. If it was literally impossible to do everything commanded of us, I was free to do what I considered to be important and let the other stuff slide. Guilt-free. This was one of the major liberating moments of my life.
A very important moment for me was when one of my mission presidents told me, with a great deal of bitterness, that he had been instructed by Salt Lake to stop baptizing so many women, because unless they were married to a man who was also Mormon, women rarely, if ever, paid enough tithing to be cost-effective members of the church. Kind of puts a spin on the injunction to stay at home and be a wife and mother, doesn't it?
I was transferred to my third area in the Philippines. Soon thereafter, an 8-year-old boy was due to be baptized. His father did not attend church, but the boy came with his mother and his younger brother. Being a little slow on occasion, it eventually dawned on me that the boy's mother did not take the sacrament, though every Saturday night she quietly tapped on our door and gave us her tithing. She had a little store downtown. I eventually commented on this to the branch president, and he told me that she could not be baptized and to forget it. I was there 8 months, and gradually the story came out. The woman and her husband were ethnic Chinese, though citizens of the Philippines. He was much older than she, by nearly 30 years. When he came setting up his business in the islands, he was gone a lot and left a wife in Taiwan. Eventually, he bought an unwanted daughter from another Chinese family and used her as a servant until she was a teen. Then she served him as a concubine and was the mother of several children, the youngest of whom started coming to church with friends and now was of age to be baptized. The issue, their relationship was not recognized by Philippine law. She had her own employment. There was nothing to prevent her from leaving him so that she could be baptized, except her own sense of what was right and wrong. She understood living with this man was not the gospel standard, but since she had been bought and sold, she also felt that it would be stealing from him to leave him, so she would not. She, of course, came to our door on Saturday night because the branch president would not accept her tithing. She had learned, however, that there would be some soft-hearted missionaries who would. And the branch president would not refuse us, though he did her. My appeals to the mission president were of no avail. She was living with a man who was not her husband. She could not marry him, since he had a legal wife in Taiwan. To leave him would dishonor the legal contract between him and her father. Her testimony must have torn her heart out. I learned that I was one of a trail of missionaries who had struggled with her situation and could come to no satisfactory solution. She was trapped between the gospel's demands and the demands of a patriarchal system that her conscience could not bridge. And so I continued for 8 months, accepting tithing in the dark.
I have a thought regarding Dallin Oaks' assertion that we should be talking more about taking responsibility than exercising or demanding rights. This rights-responsibility thing is appearing more and more in Mormon rhetoric. The problem with it is, as Margaret Toscano noted, Mormon women seem to have plenty of delegated responsibilities. It is their right within the organization to oversee and establish their responsibilities that is lacking. Responsibility devoid of rights is servitude. I'm weary of the false rhetoric dichotomies that are set up for women in the church. According to Barbara Smith and Russell Nelson, we can have integrity or visibility, charity or charisma. Why not both integrity and visibility, charity and charisma? Obviously, members of the church's male hierarchy don't have to make such choices.
Years ago, when we had our first Mormon Women's Forum retreat here in Southern California, we wanted to find an interesting way to get to know each other. So I asked everyone to think about and describe a few pivotal experiences, realizations, or events that had given each of them a feminist consciousness. I told about being invited by a BYU Family Home Evening sister to attend a meeting of the Utah Valley chapter of the Women's Political Caucus, where the ERA was being discussed. This was in 1973. I've identified myself as a feminist ever since. One of the most memorable images that emerged in the stories told that weekend was when a beautiful young law student described how she had lost most of her foot in the blades of a lawnmower when she was 5 years old, and therefore, at an early age, decided she'd better learn to be self-reliant because a man would never want her. The idea that she somehow had to be hobbled in order to escape the handicap of growing up female in the church was truly striking. I'd like to hear your pivotal moments.
My feminism started with an introduction to history, in particular women's history. And my introduction to history came while I was working for the church history department in the Old Camelot days under Leonard Arrington. I learned in very charged ways just how subversive women's history could be. My now ex-husband was totally freaked out when I started bringing home books on women's history. I remember vividly one argument with him forbidding me to read any books on women's history. This is not the sort of thing he should have said to me even during my most conservative days. I never would let anyone tell me not to read a book or not to go to a movie. I have always been fascinated that I reserve these two areas of freedom for myself, even at the points in my life where I let pretty much everything else be totally written for me by the church and by conventional wisdom. Perhaps the most dramatic event for me in my feminist awakening, if you will, was the IWY meetings in Salt Lake City in the 1970s. I had helped plan a session on Utah women's history for the conference. I had such a warm, fuzzy, idealistic feeling about what was going to happen at that conference. The horde of angry, hysterical women which descended on the Salt Palace that day frightened me and repulsed me, and things were never quite the same after that.
I'm always on the touchy-feely side, but a pivotal moment came for me when I applied some linear thinking to what I was taught in church. God was a man. Jesus was a man. The Holy Ghost was a who knows what, but it wasn't a woman. The 12 apostles were all men. Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, everyone else were men. Even the angels who appeared to them were men. Forget about the European paintings and the other angels. Virtually every person named in the Book of Mormon was a man. The president of the church was a man. The general authorities were all men. I, on the other hand, was a girl and would be that for all eternity. This led me to conclude that I was a secondary kind of creature, cherished but not to be taken seriously, like children aren't. I remember leaving seminary and walking fast so no one would catch up with me, because I was in one of those verge states where if you have to use your vocal cords at all, you're just going to bawl. But I'm practical-minded about certain things, and I set about accepting this. After all, we're not all equally talented or equally beautiful, so why assume God created only one kind of human soul of equal value? What I needed was some straight shooting and some good answers. At some point, I went on a camping trip with some kids and a favorite seminary teacher. I can't remember if I asked him in private or in front of everybody, but I laid out this evidence, and I said, look, I can accept this if someone just tells me the truth. Women are secondary to men, right? If someone is straight with me, I'll be able to reconcile myself with this, if I have the solace that it's the truth. And he didn't confirm this, of course, but I don't recall that he had much to say to me about it either. It didn't make me a feminist, but it was the end of my attempt to stoically shoulder all my dejection.
I can imagine this scene replayed over and over by just about every intelligent young woman in the church. It's a wonder any of them stay active. And most of the men are totally unaware of this and can't see why women are not happy.
While I was a missionary, any time I gave talks or passed out handouts or read a scripture aloud, I inserted gender-inclusive language in the text. It really made some people angry. But then Neil Maxwell did it, saying, "What manner of men and women ought ye to be?" And it became safe. Even my mission president did it eventually. My mission made a feminist out of me in more significant ways. I read Sisters in Spirit, Mormon Enigma, Strangers in Paradox, a whole slew of dialogue articles. A member loaned me the Sunstone that had Jean England's All Are Alike Unto God in it. Probably the most significant thing I read for keeping my wavering faith afloat. I started my mission defending polygamy and ended it arguing that the women needed better representation in mission leadership.
Two pivotal moments came to my mind. One was when I read From Housewife to Heretic by Sonia Johnson. That was about 4 years ago. That led me into the second pivotal moment. I realized that the majority of important people in my life were female, including my wife. This was written by a man. My wife, my daughter, my mother, and two very best friends. I wanted life to be as fair for them as it was for me, and I've not been the same person ever since.
My most recent pivotal moment was in the temple, when I was being washed and anointed before my endowment. I felt surrounded by the spiritual power of women, and more certain than ever that our heavenly parents do love their daughters as much as their sons, even if some of their sons just don't get it. I'm sure there's a place for women in the king and queendom of heaven, and until we get there, a place for feminists in the church.
That's your point. I apologize to everyone. I tore out the wrong page and I'm a little lost. Thank you. My pivotal moment came during a ward conference when I was 12. The stake president read all of the boys' presidencies, deacon, teacher, priest, but not the girls. I still remember the sick feeling I had in my stomach. I mean, I was fresh out of primary where Jesus loved me, and every week we got your special construction paper hearts. So to be treated as not special, when the boys still were, was totally confusing. I couldn't figure out what made the boys better than the girls. My mom didn't know either. Literally, from that moment on, I was always on the lookout for inequities. Unfortunately, there were plenty. Like the rule in my stake that girls couldn't wear gym shorts during their basketball games. We had to wear jeans or sweats. Do you know how hot it gets playing full-court basketball in jeans? Of course, the boys not only got to wear comfortable shorts, they all had matching uniforms. I also want to comment briefly on the socialization of young women. I was fourth in my high school graduating class, got a bunch of scholarships, went on a mission, graduated from BYU with a decent GPA, and then realized I'd never thought at all about what to do after the diploma. 2 years later, I still have no idea, and I'm scared to think about it. The real problem, though, is that I don't know how to think about it. It sounds silly, like I should just sit down and say, okay, I'm going to plan my future, and then do it. But for some reason, I'm frozen. I feel like I missed the how to think up a career and feel good about it fireside. And when I do try to plan, I get sidetracked trying to think up something that I could do part-time or at home in the event that I ever get married and have a kid, which looks suspiciously like idiocy since I'm single. Still, I can't shake this feeling that I should be aiming for the smog line instead of the stars.
While I was struggling with my attempts to deal with my newfound feminist leanings, I did a lot of reading, and I was struck by the incredible power and beauty of the blessings women gave in the 1900s. I decided that I would give my children mother's blessings. After my first child was born, I was working and my husband was home with her. They were not adjusting to life together very well, and I was concerned. I felt inspired to give them both a blessing. I suggested this to my husband, but he felt uncomfortable with it and refused. Instead of doing what I should have and blessing my daughter anyway, I didn't do anything. I felt an incredible loss of blessing and peace. I felt the spirit leave, and I felt like my family had lost a great experience. Several months later, I again felt the need to give my daughter a mother's blessing, and this time, I did. It was incredible. I felt words come to me, I felt the spirit's presence, and my husband was willing to be there and to listen.
When I was on my mission in Spain, my companion, who'd gone through the London MTC, said that they had been taught that by virtue of the call to be a missionary, sisters had certain privileges to bless. Specifically, we could bless people's homes, and investigators who were having a hard time. So we started doing it. The difference is subtle, but instead of saying, be to bless this home, I would say things like, by the authority I have as thy servant, I bless this home with, etc. At first it felt weird to do so, but later it felt absolutely exhilarating to me.
Many women feel a desire to bless, but feel awkward when it actually comes to the ritual itself. I wonder if this is due to all the training women receive to not give blessings, the way we are programmed to feel wrong about doing it. How could we expect to feel anything but weird about giving blessings?
You don't just undo those years of training overnight. A 19-year-old boy is more prepared to give blessings than a 50-year-old woman is.
I agree, and it was precisely this discouragement over decades that caused women to doubt and abandon abilities they actually had. Also, women likely fear church leaders' negative reactions more than they fear actually giving blessings. The fear of negative repercussions is greater than the fear of trying something new. It seems that women who do give blessings either give them privately or join with their husbands in blessing. Some women seem very aware of their right to give blessings, while others fear that it would be an apostate act. But in nearly all cases, women are quiet about the practice for fear of getting into trouble.
Someone offered to be one of the three Nephites in the Word from Hell. The Word from Hell is our sort of euphemism for our internet ward. Here's a story from our would-be Nephite. She writes, during our ERA fight, we used to give away free helium-filled balloons all along the parade route during the days of 47. The balloons read, ERA yes. We'd give them away to children, and when their parents would read the balloons, they'd scream and demand that the children let the things go. Kids were bawling and carrying on everywhere we went. I can guess who wrote this too, and this woman is hysterical. Anyway, getting the balloons around to folks who were giving them away was difficult. The first time we did this balloon scam, out of the blue, three women turned up with a huge, open-backed hay wagon-type truck. They just instantly pitched in and got balloons to people all over blazes. After the chaos of that day, I began to look for those three women with the truck, to thank them for their fabulous assistance. They were nowhere to be found. Finally, when I asked a woman who was with us and lived in Utah where those three with the truck had gone, she said, "Oh, you mean the three Nephites? No one ever knows where they go." Surely you know that. And did you notice they didn't even leave a tire track in the dirt? So the next year we were back to do our balloon scam again. When I saw the three with the truck, I said, "Before you disappear again, I want to thank you for your help this year and last year, Nephites." One said, "Yeah, well, we can't just stick around being the Nephites and all." "I've wanted to get us T-shirts made up that said Nephite number one, Nephite number two, and Nephite number three, you know, but we always get in fights about who has to be number two and just never settle the fight, so no shirts."
Okay, I'll confess. I have this fascination with three Nephite stories. I view my email friends as cut from the same fabric. They show up when you need them and leave without a trace.
It's the hearts and minds of people that email exposes. This is wonderful and warm and a much more life-enhancing method of communicating.
I agree with you, but I'm also afraid of a cyber world where contact through email and other electronic mediums replace human contact instead of supplementing it.
I'm not afraid. I think when human contact does take place, that it will be so much better because a lot of the preliminary will be out of the way. Besides that, look at the gaps that can be bridged. Old ladies like me can make friends with young ones like you. The fat, the thin, the gay, the straight, the ins and outs, the rich and poor. We can skip those barriers and look into minds and hearts.
Yes, ma'am. Any further questions?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we do 10 minutes of questions?
10 minutes.
Shall I moderate?
Please.
All right. 10 minutes of questions, comments. Yes?
I get a question. I've been on Mormon Alpha, buddy.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering if somebody could compare ELWC to what it was like LDS now.
I was on Mormon-El originally. That's how ELWC started. And Mormon-El was the list I was speaking about. It's this large, open list anyone can join. Or I don't know if it's still anyone can join. And
there's a few.
A few people that are not allowed to join. and part of it was what we felt to be really an aggressive posting on behalf usually of men. And there have been about once a year dust-ups on our list where people get their feelings hurt. But once a year compared to what we saw on Mormon-El is nothing. And so I'd say one of the first things is just what we try to attribute to modes of gender communication, that women are like more just nicer to each other. And it's true. I really do think I see in posts people writing, "In my opinion, X and Y," rather than saying, "It's this way. And if you don't believe it, you're just going to hell." And a lot of more self-exposing and feeling sort of things. So I think the whole atmosphere is different. It is supposed to be a private list. You can't get on unless somebody on the list already knows you and invites you. And so that means that although I didn't know Tanya before she was on the list, although I didn't know Tracy before she was on the list, I, in theory, know who recommended her to the list. So when I come home from church and I've had some catastrophic experience and I pour out my heart, I don't have the feeling that somebody is there who I'm not going to trust. On the other hand, this means that a lot of people are cut off. It's the hard part of making it closed and yet trying to share it at the same time. You know, those are two differences that I could think of right away.
Well, just curious, I've been invited, and just, I get overwhelmed with emails, so I've never joined the list, but some men I know that have been on the list tell me that they find it they pretty much have to lurk, that they find that their comments are usually not very welcome.
Men have, in the past, we actually had this discussion about whether men should be on the list only by invitation and should only lurk. And, in fact, there are some women on the list that have had really awful experiences with men. One of the women is the one who said, "It took me 10 fucking years to leave the church." And I know that she wrote that because she wrote originally fucking, and she's the only one who, one of the few people who will write that on the list. She is full of so many intense emotions. And I can accept that, but if a man writes something, it can often just set her off. And I respect that, and So for that purpose, I can say, yes, this is set aside as a place for you to feel safe. But we didn't want to completely silence men, so they created this other list which has no men on it, and we kept ELWC as more open. It has men on it. I know my husband was on it for a while, and he said to me, you know, he would get all tangled up about this church issue or that church issue, and I said, you know, go ahead and post it on email, and you'll get a lot of support. You'll feel great about it. He said, no, I don't feel comfortable because I'm a man, and I, you know, don't want to take the conversation time away from women. Mm-hmm. So he, in a sense, self-silenced. And as for other men, I mean, sometimes it may just be that your comments aren't picked up on. Some, you know, some posts just fall flat. Nobody comments on them. And sometimes, you know, women maybe don't respond to what men have to say. I don't know.
I've gotten a lot of insights from men on the LWC.
Yeah, I'm glad.
There are some names and that I've, people I've never met, but mm-hmm. I'm really grateful for their participation. So. Mm-hmm. LDS grads?
Yeah, that's it.
That's Tanya's list.
But okay. That came off of ELWC. I was so inspired by the community I found in ELWC, I decided to start one for singles, single grad students. Mm-hmm. So that's LDS grads.
In their manner, I don't know, maybe she's in more than one list. Maybe
she is.
Yeah.
That's like three times the volume we get. More than, or five times the volume we get in a day.
Okay. I was wondering...
Do you see that collective side?
I have, for example, I have my comprehensive exams coming up in about 10 days, and 2 months ago I had to cut the line for ELWC just to get more time in my life. It really is a time drain. So I cut that list and stayed on LDS women, which is much lower volume, mm-hmm. and LDS grads, which goes up and down. So that's an issue. And I've had a lot of people, I've watched a lot of people who have great interest in being a part of that community log in and 1 week later say, I do like this, I wish I could be here, but I have, you know, I have limits on my box, and they, you know, they start sending me warning messages when I go off my limit, or I can't fit this into my schedule, and they have to bail out.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's where you're at, then you're very lucky to have someone who does the filtering process for you.
There used to be a special, not a list, but sort of a service called Saints Best that Lynn Matthews Anderson's husband, David Anderson, would do. And he would take the call the best off of all of these lists.
But not our list.
Yeah, well, not that.
Yeah.
It's private, right?
Yeah.
But he doesn't do that anymore, I guess, for time reasons. It's too bad, because that would be great.
Carpal tunnel syndrome.
Yeah. Right, that's right.
But, you know, the volume on the list indicates how important this medium is. There are so many people who have something to say that they can't talk to anybody about. And another thing that creates a lot of volume that people complain about is there's chatter. There's chatter that goes back and forth. Some of the things aren't substantive, but it's actually a lot of chatter that reproduces what happens in a regular conversation,
yeah.
which creates the community. If it was only the substantive things, I don't think you would be inclined to come on and post, say, I had this disastrous experience today, because you wouldn't feel the community in the same way. So, yes?
I'm new at using email. And I have found one that you said anybody could just get on.
Mormon L is still open? There's actually... Even a year ago in Sunstone, the whole thing about the internet universe. And you should try to find, if you go in and ask at the desk where they have the Sunstones, get that issue of Sunstone and get that report of the whole internet universe, and then see which of those sites or lists are still up and running.
There's some web papers.
Thousands of things.
Yeah. If you want to give me your email address, I'll forward you the list of references I have. But there's IRIGEL, which is specifically for science and Mormonism. There's Alma L, which is specifically for missionary work.
There's one for primary teachers. There's one called Sister Share, which is
a relief society online.
It's a relief society online. I should mention that our list tends to get... it's got a number of people who've been excommunicated. I'll just tell you that. Or have left the church, as I mentioned this earlier woman has, and, or people who are women who go to church and do get frustrated and aggravated about what happens there and have no place else to say it, so they unload. So some people find that our list is too negative. And Sister Share is, I think, a positive. I haven't been on it, but it's meant to be a more positive thing. I mean, you know, if you're here at Sunstone, you realize this problem of these negative four how they can seem to be negative, and yet if it's your only release, it's actually medicine for you. So that's all I'll say in that respect. I think we've done.
I'd love you to hear. You were going to love your favorite topics that didn't surface.
Oh, I have one.
What was
the very first month that I was on LDS Women? I was also on ELWC at that point, and people went on to this whole post about what they looked like.
I was just going to say
and
that.
Really, this I think has really gotten famous in.
It was
circles. It was amazing.
So mind-changing.
Yeah.
We called it the body thread because people started talking.
I never had the guts.
Part of it is we have this you know, we have this community, but we've never seen each other.
Yeah.
And it was about the time, I don't know if this started it or what, people were, I guess, moving around and saying, I want to come and visit you. Or I was getting ready to go to New York City, come east. And I said, let's get together, but how will I recognize you? And a couple of people posted things which were really heart-wrenching about the way, as women, they grew up feeling that their bodies weren't right or this or that. But I'll report to you what Jane Ann said. Jane Ann, whom I met when I went to New York. And Jane Ann is typing her post. She says, well, you'll recognize me. I have long blonde hair and blue eyes and very Scandinavian features, and I look like a Valkyrie. I have delicate white shoulders, and the blue veins show through, and I have a tiny little waist, and I have this huge big ass. She really said that, and it's like obviously very memorable. This was 2 years ago. I met her. She looks like that, except she's cut her hair since then. But she looks like that. First of all, that she would acknowledge and say she was happy that she had a great big butt. You know, it's like such a heresy. How could you say that? And then she used the word ass. It's like that's a vulgarism. That's something people say about you. That's not something you say. And I said, no, it's mine. And I love it. You know? And this was important. You know, if you ever felt like you were too. That's a vulgarism. That's something. It's like obviously very memorable. This was 2 years ago. I met her. She is huge. Typing her post, she says, "Well, you'll." But I'll report to you what Jane Ann said. Jane Ann, whom I met when I went to New York, and Jane.